just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times. But I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting cam, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right, well, we made it to a Wednesday, but another day, another outrage from the dump administration. But, in all honesty, he did warn us this was coming, right? He said,
I got the biggest tax cut ever. The biggest tax cuts ever we're going to announce on Wednesday.
And sure enough, they did. It wasn't dump. It wasn't him himself, but his minions, including Steve Mnuchin. Mnuchin, he needs an extra vowel. Somebody buy that man a vowel. Actually, he can afford to buy his own vowels. He's got enough money. But he and his national security advisor, Gary Cohen, both announced this madness today. Let's see. The two biggest points, the two main points in this big tax plan are cutting corporate taxes from 35% down to 15% and lowering the tax rate for small businesses that file their returns under the individual tax code. These are changes that would benefit, businesses like the Trumps. Big breaks for the rich, not so much for the little guy. And many experts say this tax plan would cost around $6 trillion. So Trump is doing what he's uniting the country sort of against him, because this is what the real conservatives don't like. They don't like being having budget busting bills. They want, remember, they want everything paid for. Well, there are no pay fors in this at all. In fact, it's just going to boost the deficit. So it looks like there are going to be fights from both sides of the aisle on this. So heading into his 100-day mark, Dump really he's got nothing to show for it. Anyway, someone's calling to start the show from the 415 area code. Hi, who's this?
Hello, this is Glenn calling from San Francisco, and I'm off the topic of taxes, but
that's okay.
I was watching part of the FCC press conference with the corporatist commissioners.
Yep.
They're removing Title II is what it was called, ending network neutrality.
Yep, they want to end net neutrality. In fact, let me read to you what I pulled. This broke shortly before airtime, this courtesy of the Washington Post. Republican members of the Federal Communications Commission on Wednesday took the first step toward rolling back a key decision of the Obama era. The stricter rules for ISPs, for internet service providers, had made it illegal to block or slow down websites for consumers as they paved the road for other policies, such as one governing online privacy, which was overturned in a separate controversial move by Congress and Dump earlier this year. Obviously, proponents have said the rules are a vital consumer protection that ensures equal access to websites and other internet content. Like me, critics, on the other hand, have argued that the rules prevent the spread of high-speed internet, which is nonsense. What this will do, if they are successful in overturning net neutrality, it will likely signal the end of this program, because I can't afford to pay the exorbitant fees that the internet service providers would charge in order to put out. As you can tell, I have a hard enough time as it is getting a fast enough connection to get out a quality signal every day as it is. If they do this, I'm basically screwed.
Well, that was one of the arguments that Ty was proposing, that these rules make it hard for e-commerce.
Nonsense.
It was double talk. And the other commissioner, the other corporatist commissioner, made a quote that I guess that the government has more authority than the third world dictator. I thought that was good for a laugh.
Who has more authority than the third world dictator?
Presumably the government has.
Oh.
And we shouldn't be under the thumb of the government.
Oh.
We should be on the benevolent corporations.
Yeah. You know, what's insane, Gary, is, you know, basically net neutrality says online everyone's equal. My speed is no slower or faster on purpose than, say, Verizon's. Now, once they're able to gut the net neutrality laws that say all speeds are created equal, they're gonna say, okay, well, Verizon pays a premium, so their stuff will be blazing fast. But that, you know, pesky old Nicole Sandler show, she doesn't pay anything extra. We're going to slow her down to a crawl. So, you know, the video that she streams, forget about that. Maybe we'll go back to audio only. But even that might be an issue. It's really sad.
They talk about these little tiny ISPs like they were trying to protect them or something like that, rather than just have mega mergers. You know, in most municipal markets, you only have like about a duopoly, you know, to have to deal with.
That's so right. I live in Coral Springs, Florida, you know, a mid-sized, small city in Broward County, Florida. And we have two choices here. We can either go through AT&T, or Coral Springs has a contract with what was Advanced Cable, and it's now Blue Stream or something, a shitty local little cable company. One choice is the big behemoth who sucks, and the other is the small internet provider who sucks. It's the question of which one sucks worse, and I've gone back and forth with them, and frankly, I can't afford to keep them both at the same time. So I've switched back and forth, and I don't know which is worse. Neither one is better, that's for sure. But this is not going to help out either one of those. Well, actually, it probably will. It'll put more money into AT&T's pocket and probably drive the other guy out of business.
So May 18th is the date. I don't know whether this can be done administratively or whether Congress has to vote. You see, I'm a little, I'm not a little, not up on all these things.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
May 18th is the day.
Well, I will look into it, and hopefully, if not this week, certainly by next week, get an answer. In fact,
well, thanks a lot for all you do.
Well, thank you, and thank you for listening, Gary. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, Gary's calling from San Francisco. Speaking of San Francisco, there's other news happening today. I know you really care about this. Not. But Ann Coulter is off again at Berkeley. Yes. You know, the speech, she was scheduled to speak at Berkeley. Then the speech was pulled because of fear of violence. Let me just tell you, the protests at Berkeley that have turned violent have not been because of the peaceful protesters. Let me say this again. People on my side, the left, the socialists, the Democrats, the you know, the resistance to dump, they're not the violent ones. We're the people who believe in peaceful, nonviolent protest. There are agents provocateur. There are anarchists who come into a peaceful protest with the goal of disrupting it, of making it violent. And that's who we saw. In fact, there were the fascists who came into, or the so-called anti-fascists, whoever they were, who came out to one of the protests at Berkeley and started roughing people up. They were not us. It was not our group. But of course, the media, who doesn't bother to actually do their homework, or that are so concerned with being fair and balanced and say, well, there's you know, good and bad on both sides. No, there really isn't. The bad is on their side. Take it from me. Anyway, so because of fears of, hold on, net neutrality. I just want to make myself a note so I don't forget. You know, somebody floated, oh, there's going to be violent protests at Ann Coulter. Look, what I think, the way I do it, is if I live near Berkeley, I wouldn't show up. That's all. I wouldn't go. If I don't want to see somebody, I don't go. So, you know, that's the way I look at it. But I do understand those who want to get out and protest the people who are, counterproductive, right? So anyway, Ann Coulter, so after they said they would reschedule her, and Ann Coulter said something like, well, don't bother, they put it back in its original place. Well, the two conservative sponsors for her speech both pulled out. So now the speech is canceled again. Not because of Berkeley, not because of the university, but because Ann Coulter's money people said, you know what, this is too much problem for us. We're not going to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Proudscale in the chat room says, I think the people that caused violence there may have been paid provocateurs. Can you say one of Trump's best friends is Eric Prince's family? It makes you wonder. Well, Trump's got a lot of friends who have a lot of money. You know, they've got money to burn. Can you imagine if they would each put $10,000 a month into a fund? It's nothing to them. It's a drop in the bucket. They wouldn't even miss it. And put it out to people like us who are hurting. You know, but that's not the game they're in. That's not where they are. In fact, one of the other things that Dump did today, and you may not have heard about it yet, you know, this is his policy. I think it's the policy, it's the strategy of throwing shit against the wall and sees what sticks, right? You might remember after, you know, shortly, right before the end of Barack Obama's term, he designated thousands of acres of public lands as national monuments. It was in an effort to keep them free from fracking and mining and drilling, right? And it was a wonderful, effort. Of course, today, Trump signaled an end to that as he signed an executive order requiring a review of these national monuments. It's part of his push to open up more federal lands to drilling, mining, fracking, and other development. And the thing that was so heinous about it, he went on and on talking about how beautiful this land in Utah is, these thousands of acres that Obama declared national monuments to keep it free from destruction. Went on and on talking about how it's the most beautiful part of the planet, let alone the country, the planet. And, Trump's like, well, we're going to review that. We're going to turn it. The states better know how to handle that. Really, the state of Utah knows more than the nation on how to keep those lands pristine. Yeah, I think not. Again, it's the sound of the greenbacks crackling in his pocket. Hi, who's this? Calling from 205.
This is Al with Proud Skull and Chat.
Hey, Proud Skull, how are you doing?
I am doing fine. I certainly hope Tom Perez is dedicated to the 50-state strategy.
I hope so, too. You know, we didn't get to talk about this much. You know, a week ago tonight, actually, I went down to Miami to hear, well, mostly to see Bernie Sanders, but Tom Perez was with him. They were their come together tour, came to Miami, and I think going to six or seven other red and purple states, right? And it's interesting that you called in today because in about 15 minutes, we're going to talk with John Nichols of The Nation. And he's got the lead editorial in the new issue of The Nation, and it's called The First 100 Days of Resistance Restored Our Faith in Democracy. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's about. I didn't do a show last Thursday for a number of reasons, and thankfully I was able to get a good, you know, board feed of their speeches so I could bring it to you. I know most of the country didn't get to see Bernie this time out, so I was thrilled to be able to run his speech in its entirety. But on the way home in the car, David was driving, and I'm, you know, scrolling through Facebook, and I happened upon a thread about, it's you would have thought it was November all over again. It was the Hillary people smearing the Bernie people, and the Bernie people relitigating Hillary and Tom Perez. And I'll tell you, I was already a bit shaky because inside that arena, well, first, when we walked up, there was a woman out front wearing some Democratic T-shirt. And then I saw she's protesting the Democratic Party. All right. So I didn't really pay much attention. We get inside.
It's outrageous.
It really is outrageous. While Tom Perez was speaking, there were some, and they were mostly young people, who were so rude. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. There was this one schlubby guy who kept screaming out, talk policy. What's your policy? And he's doing a stump speech. He's doing a speech to try to get people excited and to come together. And this little idiot who couldn't have been more than 21, what's your policy? And I was staring at him. He probably felt my eyes boring into his back, and he turned around and looked at me, and I just mouthed to him, you're an idiot. And he goes, what? You're an idiot. And he's like, and he looked to his friend. He goes, that woman just said I'm an idiot. And I'm thinking, yeah, because you are. Well, but then the same thing happened when Bernie was speaking. He had a number of hecklers calling him a sellout and telling him to go home. And I honestly couldn't believe what I was hearing. And all I could think is,
this is the time to get together.
Yep. We're so screwed. If this is the way our side is acting, we're fucked.
We have a situation here, believe it or not, in Alabama, where the Democrats have a chance to do well against Luther Strange.
Yep.
And I don't know if the party establishment knows that.
Well, I'll mention it. I'll ask John Nichols. You know, the party. See, my problem with the Democratic Party is, as much as I keep saying, you know, they haven't learned a thing. I want them to learn something, but they don't seem to have learned anything. They didn't learn it in the fight between Keith Ellison and Tom Perez. They didn't learn it after Bernie versus Hillary. They haven't learned it now. We still have the same. Sorry, but the same antediluvian people at the head of the party, they need to clear the way for some young blood. Get Ted Lieu in there in leadership. He's the kind of
definitely.
Leader we need, right? Young, energetic, with new ideas, progressive. But you got Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Joe Crowley and Chuck Schumer. And oh, my God, enough already. And as long as they keep up with the same shit, you know, after the Tom Perez was elected to chair the Democratic Party, they also did away with the rule that was enacted during the Bernie Sanders days that said corporations couldn't sponsor the conventions and things. They're like, no, we'll take all that corporate money. It's like they learned nothing. And so There are a lot of people like me who are on the fence. Look, I'm not, I've never been a party loyalist. I said I won't leave. I won't do the big Dem exit because the alternative is even worse. But the lesser of two evils is not a winning strategy.
Well, Nicole, I called to keep your eyes on two potential candidates that are probably on the Democratic side. The mayor of my hometown, well, I was not born here, so I can't really call it my hometown, Tuscaloosa, who is Walt Maddox. He has a good chance of running against Luther Strange, and so does someone I think who may have been a guest on your show,
uh-huh.
Parker Griffith, a former congressman from Huntsville.
Okay. I don't know, but
those are the names I hear bandied about around here.
Do we know when this special election is going to be held?
This July, I think, is the primaries.
Okay.
The runoff is September 26th. And this is a strange date for the general election for Senate. It's all the way on December 12th.
Wow. That's interesting. Because, you would think they would set it up to be like, I don't know, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. But what do I know? Anyway, tomorrow Howie Klein will be back. He couldn't be with us last Thursday anyway, which was the final reason why I decided to go with the tape from the day before, from the night before last week. But Howie will be here tomorrow. And I'll definitely ask him about that. You see, the Democratic Party did it again. They stayed pretty much absent from the special election in Kansas until the very last minute when it became apparent that actually the Democrat had a chance, and the Republicans flooded the district with money and manpower, and they won it, but it was close. Closer than anyone would have ever expected a Democrat to get, especially in this congressional district in Kansas. And then in Georgia, the same thing. It wasn't the party that came out for John Ossoff. It was the groups. It was the Progressive Change Campaign Committee and Democracy for America and Move On.
It's
and those groups, right?
Very scary in Georgia because it seems like the only people going to defend that woman opponent are going to be the pro-lifers.
Well, but let's hope, because it could be those people. Look, Georgia, and this district has always been a Republican district. Don't forget, Newt Gingrich held that district
it's
for
changing.
Decades.
I've been there.
It is changing, but still, it's the Deep South. And it's been a Republican district for the last 40 years. So it's really going to be up to the grassroots. I don't think we can count on the party for anything until we get rid of the people at the top. As we're talking about the resistance, this showed up in the mail today. If you're watching on YouTube, I'm holding my Resist bumper sticker that will go on the car later this evening. And it's something that MoveOn.org is distributing. I think I got an email saying, do you want one? Just, write us back. And obviously I did. I don't even remember that I did, but I did. So look, the resistance is in our hands. And we do have a chance to make it happen, but we all need to stay involved. And that's what we're going to talk with John Nichols about. And together. And this infighting, this Bernie versus Hillary versus, it's got to stop. I'm telling you, I was so disgusted by what I read on Facebook last Wednesday night that it, sent me spiraling downhill again. These are tough times for all of us, but if we can't keep things civil between...
I'm more discouraged about what you saw at the arena.
Yeah. Well, I'll talk about that with John Nichols as well and with Howie tomorrow. While I was there, Howie actually emailed me and he said, I've heard reports that people are booing Tom Perez. Is that happening in Miami? Yep. Happened in Miami. It was, and then Bernie comes out.
Take hold, Nicole. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Yeah, then Bernie comes out on the stage and he, thanks Tom Perez, and the crowd boos. Now, on the encouraging side of it was that the crowd was young. There were a lot of millennials there. My daughter didn't come. She was going to. And of course, the last minute, she's like, I don't think I'm going to go. That's okay. What I'm going to give her a week from today, it is a week from today, isn't it? On her 18th birthday, Yeah, it is. A voter registration form. I'll have it here ready for her to fill out. And I will explain to her why she has to register as a Democrat. Why, even though today, when I feel less loyalty to the Democratic Party, I was going to say than ever, but I've felt this way for, sadly, a couple of decades already. If you want to vote in the primary in Florida, you have to be registered in the party. You know, for all the people who are screaming, Bernie's not a Democrat. I don't give a fuck. And in the state of Vermont, where he lives, where he votes, you don't have to be registered with either party to vote in the primary, if I recall correctly, certainly not to run for office. So it doesn't work that way in Vermont. It does here in Florida. So I'm going to tell her, you know, you need to be able to vote in the primary so that we get the good, the best, the most progressive candidates in as the candidate for the general election. In order to do that, you've got to be registered. So someone needs to come up with a better term than the lesser of two evils so we can, you know, put that one to rest, but say, you know, better than opening the gates to the haters. I don't know. Something. Think about it. You think of something and email them to me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. All right. Let's take a break so we don't miss out on any of our time with John Nichols. John Nichols, of course, at The Nation, has the lead editorial in the next issue of The Nation. It's called The First 100 Days of Resistance Restored Our Faith in Democracy. We'll talk with John Nichols next.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
A week after Americans filed their tax returns and the 45th president refused to release his.
I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
We'll be having a big announcement on Wednesday having to do with tax reform.
The president's preparing to unveil his brand new tax reform plan, slashing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 15%.
A rate reduction that high is going to cost above $2 trillion, and without a plan to pay for it, that's going to explode the debt.
How to pay for that tax cut, still a major sticking point.
And lower the tax rate for small businesses who file their returns under the individual tax code. Changes that would benefit, well, Trump's family empire. Democrats are sounding the alarm on what such a cut would do to the budget. Senator Sherrod Brown, when asked if the 15% was workable, said, quote, "It is if you want to blow a hole in the federal budget and cut a whole lot of things like Meals on Wheels and Lake Erie restoration and then lie about the growth rate of the economy." From the If At First You Don't Succeed Department, White House officials claim they're nearing a deal on health care legislation with the House Freedom Caucus, you know, the leftover Tea Partiers. But the text of the new bill won't be posted until the House Republicans believe they have enough votes to pass it. What we do know of the details keeps in line with the rob the poor to benefit the rich doctrine of the Trump administration. States would be able to opt out of some of the most important provisions in the Affordable Care Act, like coverage for essential health benefits and charging people with pre-existing conditions higher premiums. A little postscript. The amendment that would allow states to opt out requires that Congress and its staff get to keep all the Affordable Care Act benefits. Just saying.
We care at the world. Still isn't fair.
The race to Saturday's 100-day mark is upstaged a bit by Friday's deadline to keep the government open.
Who's going to pay for that wall? You better believe it. And they'll do it.
On day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable physical tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall.
Won't back down. No, I won't back down.
The president insisting his position hasn't changed, but he is backing away from his demand that $1 billion down payment to build that wall be included in an emergency spending bill that must be passed this week to avoid a government shutdown. The Republicans' new spending plan doesn't include money for wall construction, making the odds of a shutdown that much lower.
I hope this is not the case, but it looks like President Trump is caving on his demand for a measly $1 billion in the budget for his wall on the border with Mexico.
Ever defiant, the apprentice it insists.
Will you sign a CR to continue funding the government if it doesn't?
The wall's going to get built, folks. Just in case anybody has any question, the wall's going to get built, and the wall is going to stop drugs, and it's going to stop a lot of people from coming in that shouldn't be here.
In other news, remember this?
We'll cancel all federal funding to sanctuary cities. Out.
As the old commercial goes, he tried, but he couldn't do it.
Judge William Orrick in San Francisco issued a nationwide injunction against enforcement of President Trump's executive order to withhold federal funding from sanctuary cities. In his opinion, the judge wrote, federal funding that bears no meaningful relationship to immigration enforcement cannot be threatened merely because a jurisdiction chooses an immigration enforcement strategy of which the president disapproves. The lawsuit was brought by the city of San Francisco and Santa Clara County.
And the president himself weighed in a short time ago, tweeting, first the Ninth Circuit rules against the ban, and now it hits again on sanctuary cities. Both ridiculous rulings. See you in the Supreme Court.
And finally, like that pesky fly that keeps buzzing around your office, Michael Flynn is back. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Jason Chaffetz accused the former Trump National Security Advisor of violating the law by accepting payments from foreign governments without receiving consent from Congress, and then not properly disclosing them on a security clearance application.
If that money was received by General Flynn, and we believe that it was, that money needs to be recovered. That final determination will have to come from the Department of the Army, as well as the Department of Defense, but as a former military officer, you simply cannot take money from Russia, Turkey, or anybody else. And it appears as if he did take that money, it was inappropriate, and there are repercussions for the violation of law.
Flynn's like the gift that keeps on giving, with the unintended consequences of bringing Jason Chaffetz and Elijah Cummings together as a united front from the House Oversight Committee. Small wonders indeed. One last note. While the internet is still aghast at first daughter Ivanka Trump's appearance alongside Angela Merkel and other female leaders, the sexists at Fox so-called News are keeping the O'Reilly Ailes era alive, with Billow's former errand boy Jesse Waters making a tasteless Ivanka penis joke.
I don't really get what's going on here, but I really liked how she was speaking into that microphone.
He later attempted to clarify by saying she sounded like a smooth jazz radio DJ. No, that sounds like this.
The smoothest spot on the dial is also the smoothest spot on the net.
If you enjoy these What's News segments and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. Our work is 100% listener supported. For more information on how you can help, visit NicoleSandler.com/donate.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
No, I'm just...
Don't worry, we can't see what you want.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
All right, we are back, and John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation. As such, he is the lead editorial in the May 8th edition of the paper, The First 100 Days of Resistance Restored Our Faith in Democracy, with the caveat that says, but progressives must continue to take to the streets and push Democrats to offer a real alternative. It's been too long since we've spoken. I needed my John Nichols fix. Hello, John.
Hey, sister, it's great to be with you.
Great to talk with you always. In fact, we didn't do our usual year-end thing this year. I never got to go over the Nation Progressive Honor Roll with you. It was just...
I would have loved to have, but I'll tell you, to be honest, there were a lot of people who did honorable things last year, no doubt about it. But the truth of the matter is, I don't know what I'm going to do with the honor roll this year, because there's so many people that have stepped up.
Well,
it's been an incredible moment.
You know, that's the one good thing. This has been a discouraging last few months for a lot of people. But I keep going back to a post I found on Facebook, of all places, that I keep referring to when I'm feeling really down, which is a lot these days. And it's by a woman named Susan Keller. I have no idea who she is, but she said, I can't believe I'm saying this, but it looks like Trump is actually making America great again. Just look at the progress made since the election. And it's a long list. I'll just read you a few of the things on her list. One, unprecedented levels of ongoing civic engagement. 2, millions of Americans now know who their state and federal representatives are without having to Google. 3, millions of Americans are exercising more. They're holding signs and marching every week. And then there are others like, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is enjoying record growth in sales of antidepressants. But again, things like millions of Americans now know how to call their elected officials and know exactly what to say to be effective. You know, so things like that. And she's got about 25 or 30 of them. You know, I could go on. And it's like when you hear, you know, the people will mention the name of Steve Bannon and everybody knows who you're talking about. I don't think that many people knew who Karl Rove was back in the Bush years.
Well, I think they did once he, you know, helped to manipulate us into war.
Right, but a lot of people still didn't pay attention, right?
Well, I think the interesting thing is, I think that over time we do begin to pay attention to these people, but what's critical is it's never happened this quickly, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important thing to understand because you were around for the Bush era.
Yep.
And what happened during the Bush era was that Bush came in. He wasn't that successful initially. He was more effective than Trump. But, you know, he had a kind of a bumbling first few months and had some fights and things like that. Then 9/11 came. And, of course, 9/11 brought a lot of unity behind the sitting president. I mean, that's not an uncommon thing. And
nope.
So Bush had, you know, he had a bit of traction there, a good deal of traction for a time. And then it actually took a number of years for the center of gravity really to move to the point where, you know, a clear majority of Americans thought this guy was just the wrong person to have as president of the United States. And the people around him, Cheney and others, were even worse.
Yep.
Now, by 2006, 2007, that was hardwired in, and people, you know, an awful lot of people really got that, no matter what they had thought of him initially. What I'm suggesting is we got that in about a month.
we knew it before it even started. The whole idea of Donald Trump being president was absolutely preposterous for most of us. But unfortunately, go ahead.
Let me offer a notion there.
Yeah.
Initially, though you believe that, and I happen to agree with you, there was still a substantial number of people who went around saying, well, you know, we really don't know where he's coming from. He said so many things during the campaign. You know, he might not be this or he might be that. There was a uncertainty born of Trump's own, kind of inability to stay on message, to stay in one place. And so I do think it's significant that this first 100 days, as we come to a close of it, what we see is that Trump has very clearly defined himself. And the definition is in many ways far more unsettling than what we dealt with initially. We knew he was going to be a bad guy. Mm-hmm. I think there was a broad sense of that. But, I mean, seriously, this guy has not yet focused in on being president of the United States. He bounces around from topic to topic. He backs off things. He dives into things. He issues executive orders that are clearly ill thought, if thought at all.
Mm-hmm.
He makes appointments of people who, you know, I mean, it actually are insulting to the positions to which he's appointing these people.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
You know, people that want to dismantle their departments,
yeah.
People who are clearly at odds with the basic premises.
In every agency, it seems. He put the least qualified person for that agency head, the people who most want to dismantle it. I mean, I'm sorry. We go from Ernest Moniz to Rick Perry as Secretary of Energy.
I know.
It's inconceivable.
That's the key one.
Yes.
That really is the key. Because, you know, literally, you know, I've got a book coming out, you know, end of the summer about Trump's cabinet, about all the people that work with him.
Uh-huh.
And also his appointees, his aides and all these folks. And the argument is that Trump's not the real danger. The real danger is all the people that he has empowered.
Yeah.
And because Trump can't focus on anything for more than a day,
But you got people who now are charged with running agencies. And one of the focuses I have, cause I'm so interested that you brought it up because it's such an important one, is on Department of Energy.
Yeah.
Because the Department of Energy, I mean, we keep worrying, you know, people will say, boy, I hope Trump doesn't get us into a war. I hope, you know, Trump is, he's so casual in his talk about nukes and things like this. Well, with all due respect, the Department of Energy actually makes sure that all kinds of nuclear waste and all kinds of really dangerous or at least, you know, potentially dangerous things are well cared for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Obama put Nobel Prize winners in charge of it.
Right. Well, an actual nuclear physicist.
And here you got Rick Perry running the
who didn't even know that it had anything to do with nukes. And, you know, in that famous debate question of, you know, what agencies would you eliminate, that was his number three, oops, one that he couldn't even remember. And that's the guy. I mean, it's almost like a, you know, thumbing his nose at the, or worse, at the American people going, this is all a joke to me. This is all a joke.
That's exactly, Nicole, that's exactly right. And so I would argue, having said these things, right, that the 100 days have actually told us a lot. That we went into the 100 days with a lot of fear and concern and skepticism. Our fears, our concerns, and our skepticism was all confirmed, right? Mm-hmm. Trump turned out to be every bit as troubling or worse than we imagined on a host of fronts.
Yep.
But the flip side of it, and really that which is historic and that which we have to not just hold on to, but raise up and celebrate, is the fact that the American people responded so immediately, so overwhelmingly, and have continued to respond so consistently to Trump and Trumpism. And that's what gives me a remarkable level of faith that this country can make it through.
Yeah.
It's still going to be hard.
There's a giant but in there, though, John Nichols. And that is, you know, I'm in South Florida. And South Florida, Miami, is one of the stops that Tom Perez and Bernie Sanders made on their unification tour that you write a bit about in this piece that I will link to from my blog along with today's podcast at NicoleSandler.com after the show. I went. It was a week ago last night. A week ago tonight in Miami. Miami is not the best place to hold a rally like this, by the way. Broward County is the blue hub of Florida.
Right.
And for some reason, Bernie keeps going to Miami, which is it's just a bad place for him. But anyway, they held it there. There was about the same crowd that he had in his one campaign stop. I was at that one as well. But what was so disconcerting was the behavior of the crowd. If this is our unified front, we're in deep shit, to put it bluntly. There were people booing Tom Perez, heckling him, being incredibly rude. And then when Bernie came out, there were his hecklers calling him a sellout and worse. I was amazed at the ugliness in this crowd when it was. And for the most part, I mean, people were cheering both of them. I frankly wanted to hear Tom Perez, not being one. I was in the Keith Ellison camp in the DNC chair fight. But frankly, Perez is talking a good game and he's doing the right things to try to bring both sides together. I'm of the mind that Bernie Sanders should not give up his mailing list to the DNC because, frankly, Bernie's got my email address and it took me a hell of a long time to get off the DNC's list because I don't like what they do with the money and I don't want them spamming me all the time. But there are ways that the two sides can work together. I'm a prime example of that. But what I saw, and then this Facebook thread that I happened upon in the car ride on the way home, so discouraged and depressed me that I think we're in worse shape than we were before. The infighting among the Democrats who are still holding a grudge against Bernie Sanders and the Bernie people who are so up in arms against the Democratic Party. If they don't look at, okay, we're the alternative to what's going on there now, and if you want to get rid of them, we need to band together. And if they don't see that, I worry. I really worry what's going to happen in 4 years or two years.
It's also legitimate to worry.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's also logical. But let me suggest this.
Okay.
As painful as it is for you to see some of these things, I would argue some of this is stuff the Democratic Party has got to go through. And we have open questions, as you suggest, on whether people can come together and how that will work. But what strikes me is that the Democratic Party stumbled badly in the fall of 2016. Still won 3 million more votes for president than the Republicans, and a lot more votes for the Senate than the Republicans. But they didn't pull all the pieces together. And so there are really different camps within the Democratic Party. And whether you like it or not, they have different visions of how to go forward. If you get people, you know, kind of in the same room, and even if they're yelling a little and screaming a little, but if most people heard what Bernie Sanders said and most people heard what Tom Perez said, that's progress.
Yeah.
And so I'm not being Pollyannish here. I think there are both political parties, Democrats and Republicans, are essentially in a crisis mode because people's confidence in them is extremely low.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, young people are it's not just a confidence issue. For younger voters, it's disdain. You know, they really, and it's not just Democrats. There is a general sense that political parties are a mess. And so both of these parties, Democrats and Republicans, are going to end up remaking themselves in profound ways, or they're going to crash into a reality that I know seems unlikely because of our, you know, very dysfunctional and often regimented, imagine that, dysfunctional and regimented political system. And I know people think, well, you can't get beyond these barriers, but I've just been watching what happened in France.
Oh, God.
And that whole thing blew apart. Their political system has blown apart.
Right. It was two outsiders. It was obviously the far right, fascist Marine Le Pen versus the guy who is the total outsider, who's never been in politics before, never held office, never run for office, and is somewhat of a centrist, right? But
he is. He's kind of more of he's a guy that Obama seems to like.
Mm-hmm.
I've got problems with him on some economic issues, but. Then this is important. Remember, another 20%, almost 20% of the vote went to a far left candidate, who again was from outside the existing process.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had in France, just to give an example, where you had very long term parties that have existed for a long time and have elected leaders and, you know, are real, and that as recently as 5 years ago were getting the clear majority of the vote. These two parties. Neither of them finished in the top two, and overall, something like, if I add my numbers up right, around 70, over 70%, almost 75% of people didn't vote for either of them.
Wow.
And all I'm telling you is that as messed up and complicated as our political process is, if the Democratic Party does not emerge, let me just, instead of talking about both parties, just say one, if they don't emerge as a clearly defined progressive party that is able to link its economic populism with its absolute commitment to social justice, and that is on gender, race, and a host of other issues. If it can't pull that all together, and by the way, that is a majority politics by any measure, you are going to see people spin off in other directions. And we live in a political system where we are only, as I always say, we're 1 billionaire away from, a third party.
Oh,
Mike Bloomberg had decided, you'd have it.
Oh, absolutely. I do believe if Mike Bloomberg had run, he would have won. He could have run as a third party candidate, and he probably would have won because it would have been the alternative to either of the two unacceptable to most candidates. I mean, I still hear from people who either voted for Trump unbelievably, in my view, but did, or stayed home because they couldn't bring themselves to vote for Hillary Clinton. But the Democratic Party still, I think, hasn't learned its lesson. By Nancy Pelosi not stepping aside, by you look at our leadership, and it's Pelosi, and it's Steny Hoyer, and it's Joe Crowley, and it's Chuck Schumer, and it's the same old guard that seems like they've learned nothing. And even when they came through this contentious fight for the new chair of the party, one of the first things they did was overturn the rule that came in during the Obama years that they're not going to take corporate money to pay for conventions and things. No, we'll take your corporate money. Well, that's not what the new energy wants. We want something different. And if there's not going to be any new leadership, which is what's...
And you mentioned a lot of names there. Mm-hmm. And here's what I'll say to you. I think that clearly there's a need for new faces, no doubt about that. But I don't necessarily dismiss individuals. And I'm not, that's not my concern. My concern goes, I would argue, even deeper. And that is that it seems as if whenever you have this clear signal from the people that there's got to be a change, the centrist, for lack of a better term, kind of mushy middle, it'll step back, or maybe it'll start to speak in slightly bolder terms for a couple weeks. But then at a certain point, it reasserts itself, right? And, you keep getting this, well, we can't be too progressive, or we can't be this, or we can't be that. And all I would suggest to you is the Democratic Party has to recognize that we don't live in 1975 anymore. That we communicate in different ways. We have a radically different economy than we did. There are so many structural changes that have occurred. We're 30 years into globalization. It's changing everything about how we relate to the world. We're 20 years into a digital revolution that's changing everything about how we communicate. We're 10 years into an automation revolution that's going to change everything about how we work. And you can't go into that as a mushy middle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not going to reach people there. And I know that there's a lot of people who love that just default to let's all feel good, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's not what gets the votes.
Mm-mm.
I mean, we don't want deep division and we don't want people hating on each other. There's no question of that. But you have got to stand for stuff. And it scares the wits out of me to watch some of this, because I just don't think I think there's a lot of people who really don't get it.
No,
at a fundamental level.
You're right. The only thing that unites us is the opposition to Trump. And that, on that, we have a general consensus. But on everything else...
Which is healthy.
It is. And when you go out and you march and you're with a lot of people all on the same boat, but then when you get down to individual issues or candidates, that's when it falls apart. You know, again, the people going after Bernie for going to Omaha and campaigning for the Democratic mayor there, who... On a personal note, is, I hate the term pro-life. I feel like I'm pro-life, but I'm pro-choice. Person who is against abortion rights. Look, Marcy Kaptur is as well. She's still a good Democratic congresswoman.
Well, and I would also note that the guy in Omaha, if you look at his statements and where he's at right now, like tons of other Democrats, it appears he's evolved.
Right. And
he kind of moved toward a,
and he said, I can keep my personal, look, Joe Biden is the same way. I can keep my personal thoughts to my personal thing and still represent my constituents. By the same token,
listen, Nicole, I can run down a list of hundreds of Democrats.
Sure.
That went through that.
Of course. Yeah. Well, and that's, I think, what they're elected to do is represent their constituents, not bring their own personal biases and beliefs. Otherwise, any Catholic you know, who gets elected to Congress would have to, you know, vote their church. And that's not what we're supposed to do in this country. The same people who were screaming about Bernie, you know, going to Omaha were also screaming because when he was asked about John Ossoff, is John Ossoff a progressive? He said, I don't know. What, you want him to lie? That's business as usual. No. Guess what? That part of Georgia is not particularly progressive. He's a good center-of-the-road Democrat, which if he could win, and he could win, you know, that's a huge step. But what's wrong with Bernie being honest? I want honesty from my elected officials.
Well, so does everybody. So does just about everybody else, and that's why the guy polls is pretty close to or often the most popular major political figure.
Better than anyone else.
Once you understand that, because the Democratic Party, look, I'll tell you this, there's been a lot of sturm and drang over the last few days about, you know, what people think of Bernie Sanders and Democratic Party reaction to Bernie Sanders and stuff like that. Here's the bottom line. Right now, if the Democratic Party can't, you know, kind of wrap its head around Bernie Sanders and some of his ideas and function with him, I don't know how they're going to make this thing work.
They're not.
You know, they don't have to be Bernie Sanders, but they sure have to be able to, you know, there has to be space for him and for some of his ideas.
Right.
And I'm not even saying it's got to be all his ideas, but I'm saying there's got to be, you know, boy, if you were to say right now, there's no room for Bernie Sanders in this party.
Then I leave. Because he represents me, right? Not, of course, I'm speaking me and a lot of people like me. He's the thing that's keeping me there because he's saying we need to work together.
It's also the rising generation, right?
Yes.
I mean,
I have a daughter, like, John. My daughter turns 18 one week from today, which really kind of freaks me out. I'm going to give her, on her birthday, a voter registration form to fill out. I was saying at the beginning of the show, I will explain to her why she must register as a Democrat, because I need her to be, she needs to be able to vote in the primary. And unfortunately, that's how it works here in Florida. You want to make sure you get the best candidate in the general election, you got to vote in the primaries. This is a message that Democrats don't seem to get. And some of those bloggers and commentators who think, well, Bernie's not a real Democrat, it doesn't matter. He lives in Vermont where it's not an issue. I'm sure if he lived in Florida, he'd probably be registered as a Democrat.
Well, and also, this is an interesting thing to recognize about regional differences in the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are some parts of the country where, historically, political parties have not been as big a deal. And that's a lot of the country.
Yep.
There are other parts where they're really essential, right? They're central. And that distinction, you know, but if we get people who are casually dismissing that distinction, they're dismissing fundamentals of American politics. And for the Democratic Party, I'll give you an example. In my state of Wisconsin, when the Democratic Party was rising, when it was really coming on strong in the 50s into the 60s, virtually everyone who was a leading Democrat was a former Republican or a former third-party progressive, right?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't. Because the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, It going into mid-century, was so small it almost lost its ballot status.
Wow.
Right? It was tiny, but Franklin Roosevelt and other things caused it to grow. And so political parties, if they're smart, and this is both political parties, it's like you welcome people in, you know? And if they come with a relatively loose attachment, but a lot of following and a lot of support, well, you better find a place for them, right? Because if the only way that you can be a Democrat in this country is that you've been there for 30 years, right? Or you've got, you know, there's some sort of time limit on purity. Well, I gotta tell you, man, you go back 30 years or 33 years, Democratic Party wasn't getting 40% of the vote or barely getting 40% of the vote for president. Right?
Right.
So a lot of people come over. You build.
Yep.
And anyways, I see this, I see what's going on now as, again, as I said earlier, healthy, because you got to have these, you got to bring it out in the open, you got to talk about it. But as with any healthy process, if it doesn't lead someplace to people understanding some of the things that we're talking about here, then the crisis that the party is currently experiencing, which is two very unsuccessful election cycles, could well extend. And if it extends into 2018, 2020, you think you feel bad now? You'll feel a lot worse.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my God. I can't even imagine should he win a second term. That just, seems impossible. But it could happen. And that's the whole thing, that, you know, we need to look at the bigger picture here and look at what's at stake. And I hope, you know, people wise up. Speaking of Wisconsin, though, John Nichols, Wisconsin surprised everyone and went for Donald Trump. What's happening there? Is it going to come back?
It's not that big a deal. I mean, it's tragic for the overall dynamic because Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania narrowly went for Trump, and obviously those gave Trump his Electoral College victory. So that's a huge deal. That's a major, major development. However, if you look at Wisconsin's history, say going just back to 2000, Al Gore won Wisconsin by around 10,000 votes in 2000. In 2004, John Kerry won by, I think it was about 6,000 or 7,000 votes. These are incredibly close states. Well, Trump won in 2016 by around 20,000 votes. So, and it's same in Michigan. These are, you're talking about very, very narrow results. And so one of the mistakes people make is to think, wow, you know, the Democratic Party's over, it's collapsed, it's done for. That's not the case. You had another very, very close election result. Now, that's deeply disappointing, but it isn't an argument for saying, wow, something, you know, something so fundamental has shifted that you can never get it back. What it is an indication that no matter what people may have thought of him, no matter, you know, whether you loved the guy or had your questions with him, Barack Obama was a unique figure in American political life, history, who was able, stunningly enough, to sort of unite a lot of Democrats and a substantial portion of independents and win not just majorities, but substantial majorities, especially in what had been battleground states, right? Mm-hmm. And you live in one of them. And
yeah.
So the way to look at what happened in 2016 is that in a lot of battleground states, you had a narrow tip toward Donald Trump, but he prevailed. And that's shocking to a lot of us. It's unsettling to a lot of us. But it's not like Donald Trump won a Ronald Reagan 1980-style victory or a Franklin Roosevelt 1932-style victory.
According to him, he did.
Majority.
Right.
And that's important to remember, because if you do remember that, then it's far less disempowering. It's basically a call to action and an indication that getting the right candidate, having the right message, you know, pulling these things together really does matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, people aren't robots. It's not a robotized or systematized process. Politics has a lot of intangibles, and those intangibles in the upper Midwest went against the Democrats in 2016. It wasn't just at the presidential levels and Senate races as well.
Yep.
The last thing I'll throw on your mix, just to put on your table, is that most of these states are counter-cyclical states, and that means that when a president comes in, states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, others, tend to vote for the other party in the next election, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so 2 years on, there's rejection of the party that came in. So this is a huge opening for Democrats. It's why, the one thing I'll say is, Democrats have to get their act together quickly.
Yes.
Because they actually have an opening to win back governorships, to really reassert.
Yeah.
And that ought to be a that that ought to
create for them a sense of urgency.
And a big one, too, because let me throw this out, because 2018 is the last election before the 2020 census. And all the gerrymandering, mm-hmm. all the districting takes place based every 10 years based on the census. Whoever is in power, and it's not only, I mean, it's important to get, you know, Democrats into congressional seats, but it's even more important to get them into governor's offices to run the state legislatures, because they're going to be doing all the district lines, the drawing the districts. The 2018 election is probably the most important one we're going to see in a long time. More important than 2020, because it will dictate how the districts are drawn for the next decade.
And also, so you're right about all that. Mm-hmm. All that's the vital stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's also 2018 is the election in which we have the potential to fully disempower Donald Trump.
Yes, that's right.
Right? Remember, and this goes back to our initial conversation about the 100 days.
That's right.
Donald Trump has not even been able to get a Republican Congress to do much.
Anything.
Right?
Right.
And he's governed largely by erratic and incoherent executive orders, which are often thrown out by the courts.
Yep.
And so, I mean, I'm telling you, a good election for Democrats in 2018 puts Donald Trump into a very narrow space where his ability to govern is extremely limited. Doesn't mean he's safe or anything like that, but it does mean he can be fully checked and balanced, or at least, I should say, frequently checked and balanced.
Yes, right.
And so, I mean, why wouldn't people be excited by that prospect?
Well, they've got to be.
That excitement ought to translate. It can right now be very healthy to have a rip-roaring debate about how best to do it. Yeah, okay. Arm wrestle, flip coins, argue your points of views, have intellectual discourse, do whatever you want. But at a certain point, right, take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And figure out how you translate that wonderful feeling you have when you're out marching.
Yep.
When you're at a rally or something like that, translate that into a politics that really does unite economic justice champions with civil rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights activists, puts everybody, you know, into a space where he said, look, we're all getting hurt by this and our planet's burning up.
Yep.
You know, let's fix this thing.
Yeah. We got to be in it together. John Nichols, I can't let it go so long again without having you back on the show. It's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for being here today.
What an honor to be with you, my friend.
You take care. Thank you again. Bye-bye. John Nichols, again, he is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's got the lead editorial in the new issue, The First 100 Days of Resistance Restored Our Faith in Democracy. I will link to it from the blog at NicoleSandler.com. It's where the podcast of today's show will be. I post them there every day. If you can't listen live, you can always listen later. It's always free, though I depend on your contributions to keep us going. Okay. Tomorrow, Howie Klein returns. And then Friday, by popular demand, Greg Palast will be back with us. So we got the rest of the week all planned out and it's good to go. And I thank you for being here. I will leave you with one song. So I'm going to have to pot down YouTube in just a moment. But it was one that I left out of the pre-show music, but it certainly fits the theme. It is, it used to be my theme music. It's from one Thunderclap Newman. There's something in the air, everybody. We gotta get it together now.